Welcome back to Radio Boston's Friday Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and still with us here in Studio 3 is John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst, and Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneers Institute. Thanks for being with us, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk now about the coronavirus in Boston. Bostonians seem to be having a range of reactions to the outbreak and to the first confirmed case of the virus here in Massachusetts this week. Listeners, what's your take? Are you worried? Should we be focusing our public health energy on the coronavirus, or should we be focused on the flu? Have you experienced the other side of this virus, which is the prejudice that we've begun to see in corners? Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Share your thoughts. All right, John, Jim, here is Dr. Paul Bittinger, Chief of Emergency Preparedness at Mass General Hospital, talking with WBUR this week.
Right now, there is no sustained transmission in Massachusetts, in New England, in the United States of coronavirus. And so right now, people's risk of being exposed in their daily lives is vanishingly small.
I'm not sure that's what you'd think from listening to people talk about it. Do we have the right amount of hype going on here or too much?
Well, it depends on where you look. I mean, in some places, there's a real problem with misinformation, and the World Health Organization is really trying to fight it. They call it an infodemic because there's a tremendous amount of misinformation out there. Here in Boston and Massachusetts, I think there is a lack of context, maybe, and a surfeit of fear. And part of that is from the sort of the unknown. So people are essentially not sure what to think about it. And so you tend, human nature being what it is, to start to consider maybe the worst possible scenario instead of a realistic scenario.
Well, I caught the realistic scenario a week ago. I've been out with the flu, which you can hear.
That's why we're on the other side of the table.
That's right. So, Jim, the flu is in full swing. Have we mangled the narrative here? Are we focusing on the wrong thing, or is it important to talk about this way now?
I think it's important to talk about. We're talking about the wrong one. I think I completely agree with what John said. This is sort of the wrong information occurring in a vortex of no information, right? So, look, when you think about risk, risk is a matter of information. You can actually minimize risk if you have information. If you don't have risk, you feel like you're at risk. And given the fact, if you take a look at any of the maps, just a quick thing, if you look at any of the maps where we have seen cases, Africa does not have a single case reported. That strikes me as
the entire continent.
Yeah, that strikes me as highly anomalous given the fact that the Chinese, there are Chinese construction companies all over the place. The other things that bother you are there are 56 million people, I think, who are currently under some form of quarantine within China. Maybe in the context of China, that's not a high number. For any of us, that's a very high number. When you see the people wearing suits that look as if they're about to go into some contaminated site, to the non-doctor, you are worried about that. The fact that the Chinese government is shutting down information worries people. So that lack of information doesn't mean we should go crazy, but it means that we feel deeply at risk. It's what's led Italy to shut down all flights in and out of China. France is doing something very similar. So, I mean, I think the thing that we're talking about that's important is coronavirus we know about, but this is a strain of coronavirus, and we don't know that much about how – we don't know all the details of how it's transmitted, whether it's actually fully respiratory, if it's through touch and all the rest. We think we understand much of it. In that context, where we have a lot of students in Boston – and we're thinking about, we're in the campus of Boston University with a high level of Chinese students, and I work out with them all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there are reasons to be concerned to think about rational actions. Obviously, that's completely separate from idiots who go and engage in taunting, mockery, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I do want to pick up on that second thing. WBUR's Adrian Ma and our Common Health team have been reporting on this week. At the parade on Sunday in Chinatown celebrating the Lunar New Year, City Councilor Michelle Wu told WBUR this.
As someone who's Asian American, people are kind of looking a little bit to make just to check. And everyone wants to be safe. Everyone wants to protect themselves and their families. But when in an instance like this, we have to be very careful not to make the assumption, not to let this spill over into assumptions about an entire race of people or people who look a certain way.
And just listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join the conversation. What is on your mind about the coronavirus? John Carroll, it has spilled over. Lots of reports of racism, suspicion of Chinese Americans and Chinese national now. What do we do?
Well, you know, you try to give people more information so that they don't have some kind of blind prejudice. But, you know, you have to understand that some of this is baked in. And so this is just the occasion that brings out something that's already latent.
Yeah, we saw something similar with SARS in 2003.
Right. But then, you know, when you look, there's a lot of comparisons to SARS. One of the ones that doesn't get as much attention is the fatality rate for the coronavirus is much lower than the fatality rate for SARS, which was almost 10%. It's about 2%, you know, not great, but they're not really comparable in that way. And I think that you know, essentially people like Michelle Wu coming out and addressing the issue directly is something that can help. But I think that the more people come to grips with the fact that 8,000 people in the U.S. have died of the flu since October, as opposed to no one having died from the coronavirus, maybe that calms the fears a bit.
And, Jen, I do want to pick up on that 2%. That's an estimate right now. There has been some conversation that as cases are better reported, that could fluctuate one way or another. I don't know that we know yet.
And it's possible the Chinese government is suppressing information as well.
Yeah. So it's also impacting businesses in Chinatown. WBUR's Adrian Ma reported this. Here's Mei Deng of New Golden Gate Seafood Restaurant in Chinatown, which had no customers when he spoke with her.
After Chinese New Year, normally we are really busy. Right now, it should be at least around 5 tables or something like that, at least. So it's really hard, really difficult time to do right now. I hope everybody can come back and then to eat and then to enjoy.
Jim, we know that after the SARS in 2003, Mayor Tom Menino actually did a public breakfast in Chinatown to bring business back and increase confidence. How should our community be showing up for Chinese Americans, Chinese nationals, Chinese businesses now?
Look, you could do something very much the same thing, but I guess that's a really hard one. I guess, look, the fact is, as the doctor said, there is a vanishingly small chance you're going to contract anything. So it would be good if our public figures did something like that. My fear is this. Look, if you think about the economic impacts of this, the fact that wholesale trips to China by students anywhere in China, business trips anywhere in China are being shut down, means that this thing has filtered out across the entire, all business sectors. That's a pretty difficult thing to turn around. Whether people will follow public leaders on this one, I'm not really sure. Again, I think there are two factors here. One is lack of information, and I'm quite sure, I think, as someone who's observed this stuff around the world, that the Chinese government is suppressing information. But on the other side, we have to also recognize in the past 3 or 4 years, the rhetoric around China in this country has changed dramatically. So you already have people moving in a certain direction. There's much more animus towards China, and that includes by association Chinese people, and then you have this on top of it. That was extremely unhelpful to have all that before.
All right, we're going to move on to the tea, but before we do, I want to grab one listener call on this subject. So last word goes to Dave from Brookline. Dave, you're up.
Hi, Chernobyl. When it first happened, nothing to see. Russian government, you know, didn't say anything until it was too late and the bad things had already happened. I know this is different. I know it could be just nothing still, but do you trust the Chinese communists? I don't.
Okay, thanks for that, Dave. And I think Dave's underscoring John Carroll, this idea that there's distrust between our governments. We have a lot of rhetoric and concern. And both of you have hit on this subject of information suppression, which we know is going on.
Right. You've got a completely different information system in China. You've got basically an internet that has one big on-off switch. And China can basically turn off the internet, and they also monitor it in a really aggressive way. And people are afraid. So there are people who are afraid to report instances of coronavirus. There are people who are afraid to report deaths. There are people who are afraid to tell the truth. And China was very slow in acknowledging what was happening. The whistleblower who just died, Dr. Li, you know, basically they vilified him and made him, forced him to say, well, this is just a rumor. That set them back as well. So so I think distrust is well-founded.
I'm going to shift gears here. Listeners, how about that tea? Because it's going to get worse before it gets better. We've got a plan to include 11-month-long closure for the part of the Green Line from North Station, a month-long closure of the Green Line C and E branches, respectively, and weekday and weekend closures, plus intermittent closures on the work on the Red, blue, orange, silver lines, and commuter rail. That is every single line. Here is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek on the new plan.
Fixing the MBTA at our previous pace was not good enough. We needed to build a better T, and we needed to do it faster. So this year, we will be closing the C branch of the Green Line for the month of July, and we'll be closing the E branch of the Green Line for the month of August.
Now, Governor Charlie Baker says, hey, we are fitting decades of work into a much shorter time frame, so maybe this is short-term pain for long-term gain. But what do you think? Join the conversation. Is this going to be worth it? How much change needs to happen to tolerate this much shutdown in 1 year period? 800-423-8255. So, Jim, John, I'm going to turn to you. Jim, you first. What's your read on this accelerated plan?
It's precisely what the T should be doing. Should be applauded for it. I do worry about their capacity to manage all of these different projects. I mean, anybody who watches the folks on the inside knows that some of them are working on 8, 10, 12 projects. Making sure that you're actually doing it well is one thing. Doing it's one thing. Doing it well is a different thing. I think the questions for me are, I guess I don't really worry about this having sufficient buses. I think they've shown every single time they've done this, they've been very good and generous in providing that kind of service. But of course, you got to keep an eye on that. I wonder why, I'd love to see an examination or at least an explicit discussion of why the D line's not included here. And I only say this because of the following. Maybe it's in great condition, but if the Alston Turnpike project is going to be coming online in 18 months, 2 years, whatever, that D line, Riverside, is really important to taking people off of the turnpike or driving in. So making sure that is ready to roll with lots of trains, I think, would be really important.
Although as a D line rider, there was extensive night and weekend work done all fall, last fall.
That's going to continue through December.
Yep. Okay.
So they are doing something there.
It's just a matter of making sure they can ramp up really fast when the Turnpike Alston project gets done. That's all. And I think the last thing is towns in the area, whether it's Cambridge, Arlington, Brookline, Newton, whatever, they better be ready for micro-mobility, bicycles, scooters, and all the rest, and make sure they figure this out really well, because people are going to be turning to that in the summer.
So, John, what Jim is saying raises another question, which is, okay, so at some point these repairs are then going to be done. But what does done mean? And will it be enough? Is 2 minutes of time saved on the Silver Line, I think it is, and 4 minutes on some of the other lines enough?
Well, it depends on who you are and when you're riding. Let me just tell you a quick story. I ride the C line, the Cleveland Circle, pretty often. When they shut down street level service last time, you took a bus from Cleveland Circle to St. Mary's, which is the first above ground stop. You got onto a trolley at St. Mary's, and then it went to Kenmore. You got off the trolley at Kenmore and got onto a different trolley to go down to Park Street. So it's like Rube Goldberg is the patron saint of the MBTA.
Nice.
So there's that. There's just the physical issue. People with disabilities are at a tremendous disadvantage. I don't know if you've seen the buses. They're like tour buses.
Yeah, they are. They're like,
you know,
big Greyhounds.
There is no disability access on the buses. The idea of bus lanes is maybe workable in some areas, but it sure isn't workable on Beacon Street.
Or down on the seaport where we're going to have
exactly
buses above ground for the Silver Line.
Exactly. And the Silver Line can get in and get into the traffic jams with everybody else in the seaport, which are there. I would love to save 4 minutes on my trip from Coolidge Corner to Copley. But I just – they have to do this, but I – don't have a lot of confidence that they're going to do it in the most effective and efficient way.
So, Jim, the other question I wanted to ask, we were talking about this today, and we were like, okay, so even us as T riders and community members, we're like, man, they should fix the T. Oh, man, now they're going to fix the T, and it's going to take all this time, and now we're mad. So how does the T win here? Are we just being cranky? Is this or is this kind of, you got to get this right, pressure need to be sustained?
Not being cranky, until the data says that we're arriving on time, have fewer breakdowns and all the rest. This is Poftek's point. He's basically saying, look, this pain is going to reduce a number of unplanned disruptions of service, and they've got to deliver on that. It's to John's point about, I don't have that much confidence. They have to prove the concept. I think in this whole array of projects they're working on, Blue Line, this, that, and the other thing, Red Line, Orange Line. Red Line and Orange Line are the most important projects. They carry the most people, and they could actually, with the changes they're making, if they do it well, they could actually almost double service capacity. Sorry, capacity on the Red Line. Serve more people. Have more people sit down. That's a that would be a proof point for people to actually see improvement.
John, 30 seconds.
One quick addendum. There's a comment from the Boston Globe story about this. Someone said, "One good thing about the timing, since they traded Mookie, no one will be taking the Green Line to Fenway this summer." So there is that silver lining.
Do not see that as a silver lining. That's my hubbub. If we get to it, and it is time. We have just enough time for our hubbub. Those are those quick hits, stories, or events that caught our attention this week. John Carroll, you first. What's your hubbubbing about?
My hubbub is about Alan Dershowitz, the human Etch-a-Sketch,
who
has spent the last few weeks trying to unsay the things he had previously said about impeachment. So back in the Clinton impeachment, he said, you don't need a crime for impeachment. Now he says exactly the opposite. He goes on television and tells Anderson Cooper, I was correct in both instances. I'm just much more correct right now. Then he had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week saying that, you know, when I said the Ukraine-style quid pro quo, you know, that's not impeachable if the president thinks that it's in the public interest for him to be elected. Well, that's not really what I said. So Alan Dershowitz is involved in some mind-boggling constitutional contortions here and really in a category all his own.
Well, anytime you can put Etch-a-Sketch into a week in review, I'm happy. So how about
happy
you,
to oblige.
Jim?
Well, my gourd, this is the day that I prove that I am the pun king. My hubbub is about Charles Lieber, the Harvard chemist facing 5 years of federal prison for helping China's Wuhan province, them again, allegedly steal proprietary research. Boston Magazine's crack investigatory unit has broken news that, besides his international exploits, Professor Lieber carved out time for pumpkin else that spiced up his life. He was the pumpkin king. He was a champion grower of massive, when I say massive, I mean one-ton pumpkins with ribbons and more from competitions across New England. As they say, go big or gourd home.
Oh, good. All right. You guys
dad humor.
Ow.
When you make me laugh, I cough. You're not supposed to do that. All right. That's Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst. Thanks.
Thank you.